Nice. Soul on ice. I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, or good night. Thank you for joining us whenever or wherever you are. You are now rocking with the best. My name, of course, is Kwame. Big shout out to our Minister of Social Information, Brother B. Please help us grow by following, retweeting, whatever it may be on our social media platforms. We've got Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We also have a Reddit account and a Spotify top five music playlist that are the list of the great songs our guests have picked as their top five bangers. Everything is under the same name, Soul on Ice, the podcast. Thanks to the homie C-Dub for setting that up for us. Coming up in the show, it's Mr. World Juniors himself, Bob McKenzie. And joining me, as always, is the Get Busy Boys, my nephews. Double Trouble is in the house all the way from Brampton. We've got Elijah Roberts and holding it down in Germany, Akil Thomas. What's going on, boys?
Not too much. I thought when you said Mr. World Juniors, you're talking about Killer. I thought he took over that name from last year, but guess not.
I mean, he had a pretty good World Juniors last year. It wasn't bad, you know. Does he get the mantle of Mr. World Juniors compared to all the World Juniors that Bob McKenzie has covered and given us great moments? I don't know.
Well, you guys are making me feel pretty good about myself, so I got to humble myself right now. We went on the road the other day, 10-hour bus trip, and we lost 7-2, and it was just it was a tough game to plan. I know it was crazy. Obviously, we went up the day before, stayed in a hotel, and then like basically there's bus driver rules in Germany where they can't drive for more than a certain amount of hours in a certain amount of time. So every time we go on a road trip, we have to like either take like a taxi to the rink or like just find a way. So when we went to Schwinne, I don't even know how to pronounce it, but when we went up there, we hopped in these like they looked like army trucks, and we just like got these random guys to like just drive us to the rink.
Really? So
it was pretty cool. Cool experience.
You guys are grinding it out.
Yeah, we got slapped around. It wasn't good. We had a couple of injuries though, so we were down to 9 forwards by the end of the game, and it just wasn't great. So 10-hour bus trip back that night. Dudes and I were playing Monopoly. It's like a card game Monopoly with no like board, nothing like that. It's kind of cool. It's really cool actually. We played that until we got home at like 7 a.m.
10 so hours.
Like from like when the game ended, we got on the bus like 11:15. We ended at like 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. And we ended up rolling in our apartment at 8:30 a.m. And it was tough. That whole day was pretty much a write-off. And looks like we're going to be heading back on Sunday. So
heading back where back on to, Sunday?
Yeah, dudes will be heading back to Toronto to go, reset with his family and whatnot. And I'll be on my way to LA to just continue skating, train in hopes of a season in the near future. But this week is kind of a little sad, just because it's tough until like you know that you're gonna leave. It's like we had some fun here, some good mm-hmm. guys. So. Just went to a teammate's house tonight for dinner, and that was awesome. Just it's getting kind of sad though. For sure.
Have you been taking pictures out there on your have you been documenting visually your time out in Germany?
No, not at all. Like I'm not really a picture video guy, to be honest. But I have a couple. But like we literally just go to the rink and come home and relax, and then make dinner every day. So. We haven't been able to get out too much, especially with 20,000 cases a day in Germany. Mm. We don't want to go out because someone on our team already had it, and I think someone else has it now as well. So definitely trying to stay inside.
I don't really want to add on to the sadness, but I got to ask, now that you're all done, how many wins did you guys get? Points, all that stuff.
Just here comes the
I think we won one game. in 8 games, I believe. I've 1 assist.
Hey, there you go.
I'm snapping right now. I'm doing unreal. But no, it's actually like actually in the game when we were losing 7-2, one of our guys like destroyed one of their guys, and then a guy went up to him and just speared him, like hardest spear I've ever seen in my life. And there was a big scrum. Everyone was fighting, like punching each other and stuff. And I just happened to, you know, grab a guy, and like we knew we didn't want to like fight or whatever. And he goes to spit on the ice, and my blade was right in front of him. So he spits like a mouthful of blood on my tape. My whole blade is like bloody now. And I'm like, I look, I'm like, what? Like, what are you doing? He's like, oh man, I'm sorry, man. Is that my teeth? His whole like, his teeth are all bloody. I don't know what the hell happened to him, but that was pretty funny. And we were just talking a bit after that. And
you and the guy.
Yeah. He's like, how do you like it here and stuff? I'm like, it's pretty hard. Like, it's not easy hockey. I was very surprised at the DEL caliber of players. It's very tough hockey, and it was definitely good for me, you know, in the long run.
Kwame, before we move on, speaking of teeth, I had lost my tooth for about a month, and I could not find my tooth. And today,
you're talking about your spare tooth?
Yeah, my tooth, my front tooth.
Okay.
And I could not find it for about a month.
Okay.
And today I was moving some stuff around, and I went in an old backpack, and I found my tooth there. And I just thought, I had to mention that because it just made my whole day. And my group chat with Akil, they always are talking about how I have no tooth and all this. And I found my tooth today. So
it's like, I got to tell a nasty story about Lige. Every time we go out, we have one of our friends, not going to name who or whatever, but every time we go out, we have fun. Every time, Elijah's like tooth just happens to be in one of our friend's mouth the whole night. Like, just
what?
Like, that's wear cat, it as a bro. Trophy.
Come no. on.
No. Yeah.
That's just nasty.
I know.
It's not true, man.
It's true. That's you can't make that up. You can't make that what? Stuff up.
Oh my God. Come on, man. That's just nasty. That
it's not true, yeah. man.
You can't make it up. I'm telling you. How can you make that up?
For our audience listening right now, that's just nasty. We don't condone any of that nastiness. And I'm sure that when that happens, Elijah goes home and cleans it thoroughly.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. Okay.
We did have a little bit of silence there, but
yeah.
World Juniors are just around the corner. As we all know, Canada went out with a bang last year, winning the gold. Akil Thomas, our co-host, was the man that brought home that gold for our country. You're going to be 1-1. You're not going back, right?
No, obviously. I'm too old.
You're too old. Mm-hmm. So you have that to as your bragging rights. But what are your thoughts on World Juniors this year with COVID and everything?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a tough situation. They got to be in a bubble. Two players recently tested positive, and so the whole team is on lockdown right now. I'm pretty sure they can't even leave their hotel rooms, I think. I was just talking to a couple of buddies, and they're saying that they have Zoom workouts once a day, and they just like play video games for the rest of the day. So tough life for those guys right now, and it would be really tough for the guys who tested positive, because maybe they don't get the same opportunity to make that team as they would have had before. So it's terrible. It's a tough situation, but hopefully they can get through it, and hopefully the tournament can kind of progress and actually happen without any cancellation or anything like that. I mm-hmm. hope it'd be terrible if a team goes to the tournament, just tests positive, and just ruins the whole thing. That'd be awful. So,
yeah. Yeah. Just to add on to that, I hope like they really do get the chance to continue the tournament this year. Like Akil and I have a former teammate who really hoped that he would make the team last year and didn't make the team. And then this year is looking like he may be one of the guys on the team, and you know, Byfield, who we've had on the show, other guys who, if they don't play this year, they're going to be too old next year. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as Akil can probably attest, it's like a one in a lifetime opportunity. It's probably one of the best experiences of his life. So hopefully they can still find a way to make that tournament go on. And it'd really suck if they have to cancel.
Yeah. So, well, good luck to all the young players that are trying their hardest to make their squad, and hopefully we'll have a World Juniors. It will not be the same, but you know, the show must go on. And speaking of shows, Saturday night was one of the most interesting nights I've seen in a while in sports. Mike Tyson, he had his for Legends Only boxing match, where he was the headliner fighting Roy Jones Jr. Now, you guys are a little too young to understand how incredible or what the impact of Mike Tyson was in the 90s. That was, and I don't know if you guys ever have watched tape of him on YouTube or anything like that, but, you know, as a young man, when there was a Tyson fight on, that was, everybody came over to my crib, you know, order pizza, get ready, you know, watch all the preliminary fights. And then in one round, probably in less than a minute, Mike Tyson would just knock somebody out. So it was always a running joke of, do you buy a pay-per-view featuring Mike Tyson, because his fights didn't last long. But did any of you guys get to check it out?
I didn't get the chance to watch the whole fight, but I was kind of following it on Twitter and seeing what people were saying. And as big as it was a Tyson-Jones fight, it quickly turned into like a Nate Robinson,
Jake Paul fight. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to that in a second.
All right. Just on the Tyson fight then, I mean, my dad obviously watched him a lot. I've seen a lot of his highlights, seeing how he's the most dominant fighter that's ever lived, in my opinion. But just the whole draw thing, it's something that like I don't agree with.
No.
Like, it's how are you gonna have a draw? I don't get it. So
yeah,
that kind of ruined like part of the night. Mm-hmm. I think you gotta pick a winner somehow. But yeah, it kind of sucked to see a draw.
And I just feel like they shouldn't even fight if there's a chance of a draw. Like,
yeah,
it's like, why even fight then?
Yeah, I think I feel like they did that just because, you know, just for the show of it, I guess. I don't know. It was ridiculous, because I'll tell you this. I watched it last night, and those body shots that Mike Tyson was putting on Roy Jones Jr., it made me, I could feel it watching it. They like, Tyson looked really good, in my opinion, for, what is he, like
54
or something like that. He's like, he looked good. In my opinion, Roy Jones looked tired. But Akil, you used to train in boxing. Explain to our audience how hard it is to train and learn the actual steps of boxing.
I would say that, you know, boxing is the biggest mental challenge there is. Like, it's not even a matter of who's the fittest. It's like, who's mentally the strongest, because the training for it's so hard, and it's like, it's really as hard as you make it, if that makes sense. So like, it's pretty much all cardio, and I loved doing boxing. I felt like it was, you know, when you're training for boxing, you're just like, you're in the zone. Like, you're getting all your stress and like anger out for the day, and you just feel like you're a champion after, you know what I mean? You feel like Rocky. But no, I love, you know, training with boxing. It made me appreciate even boxers after that a little bit more, just because you look at them and you look at how quick they are. And like, after training in it, you realize like how much work they actually have to put in to be that good. And it's actually like, it doesn't make sense. Like, how talented and how hard these guys work, it's unbelievable. But no, I didn't get to see those fights. I saw the highlights and stuff, but found it was interesting that these guys decided to fight when they're around your age, which is unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly.
I just wanted to say, I know Akil's done some boxing training and all, but if Akil and I ever had a boxing match, I would end it within the first three rounds.
Really?
Be a knockout.
Okay. So, Wait. I've seen Akil train in boxing. He is actually pretty, his footwork is really good. So see, I'll give Akil that. But I think when it comes down to power, I think Elijah would have them hands have stone.
Call me. Are you forgetting of all sports, my biggest asset is my footwork and speed.
Okay.
But you see, Cormier, like Elijah's excited, obviously, as we see. And Elijah doesn't know that, like, you know, to be a good boxer, it doesn't matter if you're quick and stuff. It matters. It helps, but like you actually have to train at it. You have to know what you're doing. Like, I'd feel bad to step in a ring with Elijah right now.
Why would you feel bad?
Just because, I wouldn't want to do that to my friend. Like, come on, he's a good guy. I wouldn't want to embarrass him like that. But it's weird that you say that because I've always wanted to actually have an amateur fight just to see how it go. Because, you know, in anything, training for something and actually competing in a controlled environment is way different. And I feel like it'd be a pretty cool thing to do. So and it might be.
Speaking of that, you know, it's so true. Training in it and actually doing it are two different things. And former NBA superstar Nate Robinson figured that out really fast. I mean, that was embarrassing. So he fought, it was Nate Robinson's debut fight, and he went up against a guy named Jake Paul, who apparently online is pretty disrespectful. But this was Jake's second fight. And, you know, just from the beginning, you can see it was not going to be good. You know, Nate Robinson, he looked great. You know, he looked like, okay, and you're hearing he's been training 6 days a week, and you're like, oh, okay, this might be something good. But he would just duck his head down and rush Jake, and I would say, oh, my God, the knockout is coming soon. Like, there's no way you could keep doing that. And a guy who's probably been taking this sport a lot more serious is not going to telegraph that. And, of course, he ran in and then bong, just, and that it's become memes. It's all over social media right now. But the biggest thing that I found after that was Evander Kane. He actually went on Twitter and challenged Jake Paul to a boxing match next August 31st. And he left it with a hashtag saying your move. What are your thoughts on Evander Kane, a professional hockey player, taking a break and going into the squared circle and going a couple of rounds with a boxer? Would you want to see that?
I think that'd be sick to see. But for me as a hockey player, it's kind of just it's training for that. You know, going to mess up your hockey training regimen, because obviously any type of training is good, but you can't just train as a boxer and be an NHL player. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know if even his team would even want him to do that, just because
he probably couldn't be allowed
concussion stuff and all that stuff. And so I don't know, but did you guys see Robin Leonard's tweet?
Who Robin Leonard? I haven't seen his tweet, but for those who don't know, Robin Leonard has trained in mixed martial arts. And I remember the first time I met him and a couple of guys were telling me, they were like, you don't want to play with Robin Leonard. Like, that dude will, he'll, it's night, night for you. But yeah, what did he say?
He tweeted at Jake Paul saying, I would star you up.
I think he would.
I honestly think, I don't know if there's a hockey player out there right now that could beat Jake Paul. And that kind of just goes back to what we were saying about the training. Like, this is a second fight, and I doubt from his first fight that he's really stopped learning about boxing, learning about the game. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like as big as some hockey players are, as strong as they are, like unless they really like committed to it, I couldn't see a hockey player beating them. Just because like you, when you saw in the fight, Kwame, like I watched his first fight, like you can tell he knows a bit what he's doing. He's got his defense up. He's got his footwork up. So, I mean, maybe Leonard, because he's got some martial arts training, but like, unless Evander Kane completely committed to it, I couldn't see him winning.
You'd think that like these actual boxers out here that are actually really good and they work their tail off to be good, like they see like these guys making like so much money and getting a bunch of clout for it, they must be like, what the hell is going on? Why do these people want to see these guys like who don't even know how to box like do it? You know what I mean?
It was all a show. And like I said, I mean, you see Nate Robinson coming in there. Physically, he looks great. But as soon as the bell rang and he started charging at him, I was like, okay, that's enough. That's all I need to see. And I thought that was, I put on Facebook. I was just like, who trained Nate Robinson? Who told Nate Robinson, you know, when you're boxing, duck your head and just charge at your opponent? Like, that's going to be the strategy. But, it was very interesting. You know, Robin Leonard making some comments on Twitter. I didn't see that, but that's interesting. And Evander Kane, and we'll see what happens. I there's no way that a team is going to allow a current player to take some time off to go
and box. Which is great for Akil's sake.
That's it. Akil, I think Elijah is saying that he wants three rounds.
Elijah, just give me a date, buddy, and I'll meet you there.
Well, first of all, maybe when your career is done, because I know LA is not going to let that happen to you.
Mm.
Okay, so maybe if you can get permission from LA, we will set up a whole charity thing, get a fight going. But I doubt LA is going to. They're just going to throw away your career if they give you permission for that.
Lies, you eat grilled cheese every single day. I'm not hearing you.
You see this hand, man? You see all the scars on it?
Mm. Mm.
You're saying those punching
bike. You fell off your bike.
Punching. You know what? After this, I'm going to send you a video of Akil getting challenged, me having to step in, fight a guy because Akil couldn't fight him.
I would like love to see that video because I'd love to
in
see
Ottawa, how you in Ottawa
Photoshop a video like that.
In Ottawa, Akil remembers. You're going to have to fight in Ottawa because Akil wouldn't fight.
You had to step in for Akil.
Yeah.
Show me those hands again. Look at those hands. Those hands look like they've been through war. Akil, let me see your hands.
We got a couple scars.
You got a manicure, pedicure.
All right, I can let these two go at it all day, but we've got business to take care of. The legendary Bob McKenzie, legendary broadcaster, is going to join us in just a few seconds. So just hold tight, all right? We'll be right back. Fellas, I'm talking to you. Ladies, listen up. Manscaped has redesigned the electric trimmer. The Manscaped engineering team has spent 18 months perfecting the greatest hair trimmer for your boys down below ever created, and just released the new and improved the Lawnmower 3.0 trimmer. The Lawnmower 3.0 is simply the best hygiene tool for the modern man. Because of their ceramic blade and skin-safe technology, your snags will be reduced. We got a special hookup for everyone listening. Their Perfect Package 3.0. It comes with the new and improved lawnmower, waterproof, cordless body trimmer, performance boxer briefs that I'm wearing right now as we record this show, and a travel bag for you to use when we're all done quarantining. The Perfect Package 3.0 also comes with the Crop Preserver and Crop Reviver. The Crop Preserver is an anti-chafing deodorant, which ensures that your afternoon stroll doesn't end up with your boy sticking to your leg. You don't want that. The Crop Reviver is a spray-on toner for your boys down below. It's made with soothing aloe and witch hazel extracts that will give your boys that extra boost. That boost, I don't know what it is, but it's an extra boost you might need. Now, you can get 20% off and free shipping, and all you have to do is use the promo code SOUL, S-O-U-L, at manscaped.com. This is a limited time offer for the Manscaped All-Star lineup. I'm going to be honest with you, boys and girls. I got it. I used it. I'm pleased. Now, if this thing was around in my early 20s, it would have saved a lot of embarrassment. So make sure you pick yours up right now. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SOUL, S-O-U-L, at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com by using the code SOUL, S-O-U-L. So when you're thinking about hockey, upgrade the blue line, my fellas, and choose Manscaped. It's for the most important male grooming needs ever. Since joining the Canadian Sports Network, TSN, our next guest has analyzed some of the greatest games on ice. He's covered the World Juniors, and his draft rankings are some of the most anticipated in all of sports, at least hockey for sure. He has written countless books, 10 if I'm correct, and his latest is called Everyday Hockey Heroes, Volume 2. He's a Gemini Award winner for Best Studio Analysis and one of the most respected, well-respected broadcasters in the game. So all my soul brothers and soul sisters out there, let me introduce to you Bob the Mac McKenzie. How you doing, Bob?
Excellent, Kwame. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for joining us. I hope you don't mind me giving you the mantle, the Mac.
That's, you know what? As long as you don't try to make up your own nickname, you're okay if somebody bestows one on you. It's okay.
That's true. And it's a classic blaxploitation movie from back in the days. So if you've never seen it, you should watch it. It's a great one.
Awesome. I've not seen it, but now I will have to check it out.
How do we describe the Gemini Awards to our listeners down south of the border? And what game did you analyze to win that award?
Well, I don't even remember. I've gotten two, which is not very many compared to James Duffy, who's got my colleague, who's got like 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. But it's like an Emmy. So it's like you're basically, and they've changed the name. It used to be the Geminis, and now it's called the Green something or other. I forget the name of it. Mm-hmm. The new ones. I got one Gemini and one Screen Award, whatever they're called. But it's like winning an Emmy in the United States.
You got to be proud of that, though, right?
Yeah, you know what? It's a funny business to be in. I mean, to be in the television business or the journalism business or whatever, media, call it whatever you want, it's not really... You never really get into it thinking I want to get in and win some awards. Mm-hmm. So when you get one, you're kind of like, it's kind of weird, but whatever. It's cool. I mean, it's always nice. Hey, listen, is it nice to get recognition? Yes. Do you go into anything thinking, oh man, this is, I'm going to get an award for this? No, you don't do it. And whatever I did, I think it was for a World Junior Tournament Studio Analysis in one time, and another one was just NHL Studio Analysis or whatever.
I think one of them was one of the World Juniors that you did the analysis for, and it had a great World Junior team. It had Tavares, Simmons, Stamkos, Giroux, Marchand, Subban, just to name a few. Do you remember that
team?
Yeah,
that would have been 08 or 09. Like it was, there was one in Ottawa, and then Tavares' first year was the one before that. When he was really young, but the Ottawa one was a really good one. That was the one where Eberle scored the goal in the final seconds against the Russians, and then Canada beat Sweden in the gold medal game. And that was also the Ottawa tournament was where on New Year's Eve Tavares had the hat trick after the Canadians fell behind the Americans 3-0 in Ottawa. You could hear a pin drop in the rink. 3-0. Place was sold out and rocking, and all of a sudden it's like all the air was out of the building, and then Canada came chipping away at it, and they ended up winning the hockey game. That was a pretty spectacular night of junior hockey.
How do you find there's a huge difference in national excitement during World Juniors between the U.S. and Canada, you know, from a broadcaster's vantage point? Explain to people outside of Canada what World Juniors means for us each year.
Well, it's become a huge tournament for TSN, but it's become a huge tournament for Canadians. And And part of the reason is the time of the year. It happens at Christmas and New Year's. So if I was trying to translate that to Americans, you know how excited Americans would get by the various bowl games that are going on between Christmas and New Year's. And, you know, that's an exciting time for football fans to watch all that college football. And it's so good. And there's so many great bowl games on. Well, think, you know, day after day, multiple bowl games every day for almost a 2-week period. And that's what you've got with 8-10 international teams. It's the only annual best on best tournament in hockey. I mean, the world championships for the men's, all the best NHLers are still playing in the playoffs, but the World Juniors is the only annual event where most of the countries get most of their best players together. And so as a result of the time of year, the quality of the hockey, and the unpredictability of teenagers playing a sport, you know, no lead is safe. It could be 4-5-0 and a team will come back from that deficit. Whereas in the NHL, that rarely happens.
So, you know, obviously World Juniors is, you know, always incredible to watch. You know, I remember being a little kid looking forward to Christmas every year just because of World Juniors and, you know, watching it closely every year and, you know, seeing you on TV all the time. And, you know, what was the greatest World Junior game you've ever watched in your opinion?
Oh boy, that's such a good question, Akil. And hey, listen, game-winning goal in the World Juniors for you. That always looks good on the resume for the rest of your life, man. As soon as you say Akil Thomas, people are going, well, that's the guy that scored the World Junior game-winning goal. And so congratulations on that. But that New Year's Eve game with was cool in Ottawa that I talked about. The Eberle goal against the Russians. Canada should have, like, you know, that was the year that Canada won it in Ottawa. That was, I think, the fifth straight year that they won it. And they never should have won it because the Russians had the game. It was over. And then the Russians iced the puck and Canada, the goalie pulled. And then they had a tough time clearing the puck. And Eberle scored that goal with, you know, just a couple of seconds left. And that game should have been over and done with. And suddenly Canada wins that game and then beat Sweden in the gold medal game. That was one of the most memorable. But there have been so many of them over the years. Boy, oh boy, when I think about it. And the tournament changed too, because in 1996, they started playoff format that we use now. Whereas prior to that, it was just a 7-game round robin tournament. And so you play your 7 games and that's the way it goes. If you happen to make a misstep along the way, there was nothing you could do about it. But some of those were pretty cool too. 95 in Red Deer, Canada went 7-0. And I can remember some great games and historic moments at the World Juniors.
Okay, so this might be a tough question too, because there have been so many you know, dominant players in the World Juniors throughout the years. Who, in your opinion, has had the most dominant performance in World Juniors who isn't Canadian?
That's actually, it's pretty easy because there's two guys that come immediately to mind. And one of them is Pavel Bure and one of them is Peter Forsberg. Mm-hmm. Forsberg, I think, Bure played in 3 World Juniors, because I saw Bure as a 16-year-old in Anchorage, Alaska in 1989. I saw him as a 17-year-old in 1990 in Helsinki. And I saw him as an 18-year-old in 1991 in Saskatoon. And he was spectacular in all 3 of those tournaments. And Peter Forsberg played in 2 tournaments and was just so thoroughly dominant, like you wouldn't believe, especially in the 93 tournament, which Canada won. But Forsberg was—he was lights out. So those are the two, in my mind, those would probably be the top 2 players of all time, including Canadians at the World Juniors. You know, I could throw Wayne Gretzky, and he only played 1. It was the very first World Junior I ever saw, 1978 Christmas Day. That was the first time most people saw Wayne Gretzky, for probably his first time on national television as a 16-year-old for Canada, and he had 5 points against the Czechs, and you're like looking at this little skinny kid and you're saying, man, I don't know if he's gonna make it in the NHL or not, but boy oh boy, is he ever good here today. And of course we know what happened after that.
Yeah. You know, and just staying on the subject of World Juniors, and of course, Akil Thomas, you bringing up his game-winning goal. What were your thoughts of that World Juniors, you know, when you think of Akil Thomas? Because throughout the tournament, the name bubbled a little bit, and then all of a sudden, this huge moment. For a person in your position who has covered this tournament for so many years, what were your thoughts during it and then after?
Well, I think you can, you know, and Akil would be able to speak about this better, but from the outside looking in, you know, it was a case where as the game went deeper in the tournament, and in that particular game, Akil wasn't probably playing nearly as much as he wanted to play. And then all of a sudden, you know, but he's out there at a crucial moment in the most crucial game, and he takes full advantage of it and scores a goal. And I think it just speaks to the depth of talent that Canada has. And so when you're a coaching staff and you're trying to mix and match and give yourself the best chance to win, you know, you saw Quinton Byfield started the tournament fairly high in the lineup. And then by the time the tournament was over, he was way further down the depth chart. But, you know, and a couple of years ago, we saw the exact same thing happen to Alexis Lafreniere in Vancouver at the World Juniors. And, you know, he ended up being like a fourth line guy. And then last year, a year later, Alexis Lafreniere shows up, and as Akil will tell you, he was the dominant player in the tournament and was a huge reason, in addition to Akil's game-winning goal, why Canada won the gold. And that gives you some idea of what a difference a year can make, and also just what a difference from game to game, shift to shift, when coaches have to mix and match their lines, everybody's got to be ready to go. And, you know, to Akil's point, I mean, you know, it would have been easy to be thinking, ah, man, I'd like to be out there more on a consistent basis or whatever, but he had to be ready. And when he got his chance, he was ready, and Canada won the gold medal because of it.
Mm. Well, we don't want to swell up his head too much right now. So we're going to keep moving on and talk about you, Bob. You were more of a writer before you transitioned onto camera. How did that happen for you? And what job would you say is more stressful?
Well, I only ever wanted to be a hockey writer. I had no designs on being a broadcaster or being on television or radio or any of that stuff. I never wanted to be, quote unquote, the hockey insider, the title that was given to me along the way. I just wanted to write about hockey. And, you know, my first job after I graduated from Ryerson in Toronto Journalism School was to go cover the Sioux Greyhounds in the Ontario Hockey League for the Sioux Star. So I did that for a couple of years, and I wanted to be a beat reporter for one of the Toronto papers. I wanted to cover the Toronto Maple Leafs for the Globe and Mail or the Toronto Sun or the Toronto Star, but I couldn't seem to break through and get the job there. I ended up becoming editor-in-chief of the Hockey News when I was 25 years old in Toronto, and it wasn't exactly a hockey writing job because there were so many more things that went with it, but I did that, and over time, I started to kind of cross over around 86, 87, started to do a little bit of television work, and one thing led to another, and, you know, and here we are all these years later. As far as stressful goes, I don't know. I guess probably when I was first starting out, it was stressful on television because it was a new medium, and I wasn't very good at it, and it wasn't that well-spoken, and you're kind of nervous and self-conscious a little bit, but you know, writing's hard too. Writing's a painful process for me, but it's kind of a rewarding one. But it's a different kind of stress in terms of looking for that right word. And when you're on television, you don't have time to think about it. You just got to let it rip.
Yeah.
What would you say your favorite part about broadcasting is? And what would you say the hardest part about it is?
Favorite part is getting to work with a whole bunch of really good people. So at TSN, we got James Duthie, Darren Dreger, Pierre LeBrun, Frank Saravalli, Ray Ferraro, Gordon Miller, the list goes on and on. We've just got so many good people, and it's such a joy to go into the studio with those guys or to go to a World Junior tournament or a Stanley Cup final. But it's really like being part of a team. And so there's this tremendous amount of camaraderie that we have on the TSN team. And for that, for me, is the best part. And everybody's really good at their job. So if we have a day like NHL trade deadline day, or free agent frenzy day, where you start work at 7, 8 in the morning and you're on air for 10, 12, 14 hours a day. You know, that and that's where the full display of all of the talent comes to the fore. People both on camera and behind the scenes. That's the kind of day where you say, this is really gratifying. It's really exciting. The hardest part of it, I don't know. I wouldn't say it's overly hard. I mean, I always joke and tell people there's no heavy lifting and it's all mostly indoors. So you can do it for a good long time without breaking your back.
Nice. A question I'm always curious about with our guests is their origin story. How did you get into hockey and what's your hockey origin story?
Well, you know, Canadian kid, so no different than Akil. Growing up in Scarborough, Ontario, you know, from being like 5 years old, having a hockey net and a stick and being out on the road and playing road hockey with my buddies. Parents putting you on skates at a young age. And you know, I started probably playing in a league, Dorset Park House League, McGregor Park Arena at Lawrence and Kennedy area of Scarborough. And that's just where I got started. And I just had a passion for it and really loved it. I was never very good at it, but nevertheless, I got to play it for a good long time. I played right through, you know, if you have, put it this way, Kwame, if you have juvenile on your hockey resume, you're not a very good player. Juvenile hockey is usually where hockey dreams not only go to die, but have died for years before that. I played juvenile hockey and then I played intermediate on top of that. So like, you know, now you've got like minor midget at 15 and you got midget at 16 and 17. And then you had juvenile at 18 and 19 and then you had intermediate at 20 and 21. And I played right through till I was 21 there and in intermediate hockey, but I just really had a passion for it, really enjoyed the game. And as I said, never very good, but loved to play.
I peg you for a strong third liner, a grinder. what kind of player were you? What would you say you're at the top of your game?
Compared to like elite, really good players like Akil or those that have gone on to play the game, I wasn't even in their universe. But within my universe of the guys I played with and the levels I played at, I was a decent scoring right winger who transitioned to play some defense in juvenile. So there you go.
Okay. When you came up playing, the game felt and looked a lot different than it does today. Yeah. You know, as a player, an ex-player, writer, on-camera broadcaster, what has been some of the major shifts in the game that really stood out or stand out to you?
Well, obviously, I mean, when you talk about hockey and when you talk about growing up in Scarborough now, let me ask Akil a question. Akil, what part of Scarborough you grew up in?
Like Victoria Park and 401.
Victoria Park and 401. Cool. I used to play soccer up there at Terra View Heights, just up pharmacy there when I was a kid. But I grew up in Brimorton and McCowan, just south of the Scarborough Town Center. So when I grew up in Scarborough in the 1960s, it was quite white. And now the Scarborough that Akil grew up in is one of the most racially diverse communities in all of Canada. So, Canada, the various communities we all grew up in, there's been a huge shift in terms of the diversity of it. And the same thing could be said, not to the same degree, but to some degree for the game of hockey as well. And so that's been one of the biggest changes. And obviously for your audience, Kwame and Akil, there's no doubt about that. When I grew up playing minor hockey, I think I want to say a minor Adam or Adam, I had one black teammate, and then a juvenile, I had one black teammate. I did recall two players in particular that I played against that were black. Now they stood out because they were black, for obvious reasons in a mostly white game. But they also stood out because they were like really good players I was born in 1956. And so, you know, it wasn't unheard of to have black players back then because Mike Marzen, who was the second black player to play in the National Hockey League and really the first one to play for a prolonged period of time, Willie O'Ree broke the color barriers. I don't need to tell you guys that. But, you know, relatively brief career in the National Hockey League compared to some. Mike Marzen played for a longer period of time. He was born the year before me, and I didn't know Mike growing up or know of him until he got to the Sudbury Wolves in junior. But there were some black players in Scarborough, and these two players that I played against in the 1956 birth year, I remember them because they were black in a mostly white game, but I also remember them because they were really good, way better than I was. They were the upper echelon of players in our age group. And I also remember them because they had unique names. One guy's name was Terry Mercury, mm-hmm. and the other guy's name was Lindbergh Gonzalez. Those weren't names that you quickly forgot. And when I was getting ready to write this book, Everyday Hockey Heroes, Volume 2, and I started thinking about where I grew up, where Akil grew up in Scarborough. We did a chapter on Wayne Simmonds in our first volume of Everyday Hockey Heroes about growing up with some economic hardship and obviously some racial issues in Scarborough as well, but to become the player that he was and give back to his community. And I started thinking about, you know, Scarborough, as quite white as it was back then, has now put more black players in the National Hockey League than any other community that I can think of. That's right. Counted 10. Mm-hmm. And I think, and I always tell people Akil is going to be number 11. Mm-hmm. So Mike Marzen was number one, but you've got Anson Carter, Kevin Weeks, you got the Stewart brothers, Anthony and Chris, Joel Ward. And then there were some guys, Nathan Robinson and Chris Beckford Sue had cups of coffee, a couple of games here or there, whatever. But, you know, 10 players from one community, mm-hmm. 10 black players from one community in the greater Toronto area of Scarborough is pretty incredible. And so I started thinking about, well, when I was a kid, you know, there just weren't very many black players. And so I thought, wouldn't it be kind of interesting to go back and track down Terry Mercury and track down Lindbergh Gonzalez and talk to them about what was their experience like versus what my experience was like. Mm. It's got to be different. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And it was. And so that's the first chapter of the book that we just did, Everyday Hockey Heroes. And it was really illuminating and enlightening for me. And I think it was, you know, Terry and Lindbergh both said it was really good for them, almost a cathartic experience to be able to get some of the experiences off of their, you know, the stories they wanted to tell and get some things off their chest. And it was really good for them too, I think.
Terry Mercury is a friend of mine, and he's actually the one that got me to get in contact with you as well. Do you know who he's related to?
Yes. Okay. He's Wayne Simmonds' cousin.
Yeah.
And the other thing I found fascinating about Terry when he's telling me his story of his family is on his, is the mum's side. Terry's a sixth generation Canadian.
Yes.
And his family roots go back to Virginia. And the Underground Railroad railroad coming through to Canada back six generations ago, which is absolutely amazing.
Very interesting story. Very good guy, and that whole family's got some deep roots in Canada, and it's really good to see, especially with the progress Wayne Simmonds is having in his career, and coming to Toronto next year is going to be very exciting as well. Akil, you got the next one.
Yeah. So while you mentioned your book called Everyday Heroes, what's the theme around this book?
Well, I think it's what I'd like, I guess, in broad brush terms, I would say it's a book about hockey culture. But what I would like to think is new hockey culture. You know, hockey culture gets a negative connotation, and understandably so for a lot of reasons, because there are a lot of times when hockey culture doesn't measure up in terms of diversity or inclusion. And that can be about, it can be racial and for black, indigenous, people of color. But it can also be for sexual orientation for the LGBTQ community. It could be because of having a physical disability. There's a lot of people who find themselves for one reason or another feeling as though they're kind of pushed to the outside, the margins, if you will, of hockey culture. And so with Everyday Hockey Heroes, first and foremost, we want to tell some really inspiring, entertaining, and interesting stories And the common denominator is everybody who's featured in Everyday Hockey Heroes, both Volume 1 and Volume 2. Number one, they love hockey. They have an incredible passion for the game. But for one reason or another, they maybe have some adversity to overcome or some hurdles to try and get over. And so the stories of getting over those hurdles or breaking down barriers or breaking down walls, you know, there's at least four chapters in this Everyday Hockey Heroes Volume 2 that are really a soaring tribute to women and some of the glass ceiling they're trying to shatter and make their way in the game. So it's a new age hockey culture book about, you know, overcoming adversity and hurdles to get to a real good place and maybe serve as an inspiration and a mentor to somebody else who might be in that demographic who feels maybe they're being marginalized for whatever reason within hockey, and that there's still hope that they can make their breakthrough and come out the other side and be as happy with the game as a lot of the people in this book.
For everybody listening right now, the book is called Everyday Hockey Heroes. Make sure you go and pick that up. Great read, Volume 2. So the chapter you had Terry Mercury in was called Black and White. That's the first chapter in the book. You know, in this day and age where we are with hockey, with social justice movements, was that the main reason why you wanted to put that chapter in there? And after you did, was it kind of, you know, something that you needed to get off your chest as well?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. There's a lot to unpack there. So obviously this summer we've had in George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and all of that, It's changed the way I think everybody views the world, or at least it should have changed the way everybody views the world to have a better understanding of some of the problems that people of color face. But obviously the idea that I had to talk to Terry and Lindbergh about this, it dated back to late last fall. You know, in the winter, I started thinking about this idea, and I didn't actually start putting it together until January and February, but I didn't interview them until right around March. It was right around the time the pandemic really started to go great guns. So it was a bit of a challenge initially to get the time to sit down with Terry and Lindbergh. But on that subject, you know, as I say, I grew up in Scarborough, and as I often refer to it as quite white Scarborough. But I, from a very early age, I know personally myself, speaking only for myself, I always felt like I was acutely aware of the issues for Black people. And one of the books that I remember reading in school, Bendale Public School, I was in grade, I want to say it was grade 6, was a book called Black Like Me. Mm-hmm. And it was written by a white man who actually had the pigmentation of his skin changed.
Yeah.
To look like a Black person. And then he traveled through the southern states, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and wrote about it. And you know, it was a story of very harsh and overt racism, as you might expect. And because this was done in the late, he actually did the book in 58 or 59. I was reading it in probably, you know, in the mid 60s. But I immediately, it struck me on a visceral level, just what acute racism really looks like. And the 60s was a really crazy time to grow up, especially as I love sports. And so, you know, I think of some of the seismic things that happened in sports regarding race relations in the 1960s. I think back to John Carlos and Tommy Smith at the Mexico Olympics and the Black Glove Salute. I think about Muhammad Ali changing his name and then basically abandoning his title, having stripped of his heavyweight title of the world, and ultimately, you know, prepared to go to prison to back his status as a conscientious objector, and plus everything that was going on in the late 60s in terms of race riots in the U.S. cities this past summer. Some parallels there in terms of the civil unrest and all that was going on. So, you know, I'm only saying that as a white person who grew up in a mostly white community, I was always aware of the struggle that Black people had as far as racism goes. Now, you know, did I do enough about it or whatever? I guess probably not. I mean, but, you know, so I guess when I was thinking about the book and I was thinking about, initially I thought about the Wayne Simmons chapter in volume one. And I started thinking about growing up in Scarborough and just what I talked about earlier, Scarborough putting more Black players in the National Hockey League than anybody else. And I just thought it would be an appropriate time to go back and try and track down Terry and Lindbergh and get their stories. And hopefully, because I think there's elderly white people like myself, you know, some people are willfully ignorant when it comes to issues of race. But there's some people who I would call blissfully ignorant. And that is, they just don't think about it. And I'd like to think that there might be some of those people that would read the chapter on Terry Mercury and Lindbergh Gonzalez and comparing and contrasting my experience with their experience. And that it might twig a little something to them just in terms of, wow, you know, this is a problem. It's always been a problem. It's still a problem now. And these are problems that need to be addressed. And maybe there's the first step, I guess, to doing something about it is at least being aware of it. So hopefully there'll be some people that that feel that way.
Just as you were talking about your book there, I put on my reminders list to go get one. So I'm looking forward to getting that in my hands. So, you know,
Akil, you know what you can do? And then we'll get you a book. That's no problem. But you can go to simonandschuster.com. And if you look Everyday Hockey Hero, simonandschuster.com, it'll come up. You'll see a profile of it. And then there'll be a tab that says excerpt. And you can actually read the first chapter on Terry and Lindbergh and myself for free. So you can, as soon as hop off here, you can jump on and give it a read. So that chapter, but we'll make sure you get a book too.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Anyways, just to switch gears here a little bit. You know, when I think of you, I think of two main things. I think of World Juniors and I think of the draft, you know, the end of the year, Bob's list, his final rankings. And not too long ago, we saw the draft happen virtually for the first time, I think. And, you know, it seemed for me when the season ended, you know, it seemed like Byfield was pretty solid looking at number two. And it seemed like, you know, as the draft got closer and closer, you just started hearing buzz around, you know, Stutzla possibly going two. You saw more rankings of Stutzla going two like yours. Yeah. And, you know, I was curious to think, you know, what your reasoning behind slotting Stutzla ahead of Byfield was.
Well, when I do my draft rankings, Akil, it's not what I think. It's simply a consensus of what the scouts think. And so I have 10 NHL chief scouts who I've got relationships with, and I'm able to they share their information with me. And so when I do when I go to them, I'll say, give me a numerical ranking. And there were, you know, it was very close between Stutzel and Quentin Byfield. And the only thing that separated, I think they had the same number of second place votes at number two overall behind Lafreniere, who of course had all 10 scouts had him at number one. But the only difference was, I think one scout had Quentin down at number five or number four and Stutzel was at number three. So it was a razor thin margin and it was really 6-5 pick 'em. You could go either way. On either guy, there was like virtually nothing separating the two. And it's funny because earlier in the year, I would have said Quentin was clearly the number two guy. And then Stutzel came on really strong at the World Juniors and was pretty dynamic even in the second half of the season, playing against men in the league you're playing in now, I guess, in Germany. And so then all of a sudden, after the World Juniors and Quentin, you know, not that there's anything wrong with it, because as I said, 2 years ago, Alexei Lafreniere didn't play well at the World Juniors. A year later, he dominated them. I wouldn't be surprised if Quentin dominates them this year. But after the World Juniors, and even I thought Quentin was just so-so at the CHL Prospects game, that I would say through January, February, and March, things really started to pick up steam for Stutzel ahead of Byfield. But that as it got closer and closer to the draft, you know, a lot of people started to default to, yeah, you know what, 6'4", you know, 215-pound, number one center that can make plays, score goals. That's a tough one to pass on. And suddenly there seemed to be a lot more of Quinton coming back at number two. But I said from the get-go, Stutzel, Byfield, there's nothing separating these two guys. And it would really be just the preference of the team that was picking at two. The Kings were obviously picking at two. And now you get some company there.
Right. I always think that, you know, the draft is kind of interesting because, you know, you're drafting kids when they're, you know, 18, and so much can change. And some kids could be fully developed physically at that time, and some kids could be very well not even done growing, or obviously have some room to get some strength in. But, you know, there you always hear of players like, you know, Pavel Datsyuk, Nikita Kucherov, who got drafted in later rounds. Would you say that there was any prospect throughout the years that you were super high on, and, you know, maybe other scouts didn't like him at all, probably got drafted later, who, you know, maybe went on to be, you know, a remarkable NHL player?
Well, there's been so many examples of those. And I mean, some of them turned out to be like, like the best players in the game. You mentioned Datsyuk in the seventh round, Zetterberg, you know, Nick Lidstrom wasn't a high pick. It's when you look at some of those Detroit Red Wing teams, the dynasty, the core guys, so many of them were almost draft afterthoughts. And then you get guys who weren't drafted at all, you know, or really late picks like Brett Hull and Luke Robitaille. They go on to be Hall of Fame scorers. I'm not sure there's any that, you know, I knew of that turned out to be great. It's not like I'm a real scout anyways. I just kind of listen to what the scouts tell me as opposed to things, decisions that I make of my own. But it's an inexact science. There's no doubt about that. And I mean, you can see it yourself as you grow up. Just even looking at the OHL draft, you know, how does a kid like Anthony Cirelli wasn't even taken in the OHL draft. And then not only does he go on to be a Memorial Cup champion with a game winning goal in overtime, but goes on to be as good as he was for the Stanley Cup champion Tampa Bay Lightning. And it's funny the way some kids are just late bloomers and they kind of fall through the cracks for one reason or another. There's no real way to explain that. And some of the kids, the flip side is, you know, somebody could be taken in top five, top 10 in the draft, and they never really pan out. So that's both ways.
Speaking of draft and scouts and all that, how did the Arizona Coyotes scouts, how did they drop the ball?
You're talking on the Mitch Miller thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? Well, they obviously were aware of what had gone on, and they had probably decided that they were okay with it, or that you know, ultimately, you know, you're going to give him another chance, or he's made amends, or was in their eyes, it was good enough. And then when the story came out, and it's funny because I do draft rankings, but I'm really focused on most of the first round. I end up doing 90 or 100 usually, and I talk to the scouts and get numerical rankings. And Miller wasn't in our top 100. I went back after the fact, after the story broke about him, because this is a roundabout way of saying I wasn't aware of anything that had gone on in this kid's past or his experiences that he got into trouble for and what have you. But so after the fact, I went and looked, and of the 10 scouts I talked to, only one of the 10 mentioned him as somebody they would take in the first three rounds. And it wasn't nearly good enough to get on the TSN top 100 list. And even if he had been on the TSN top 100 list, as I said, I don't do a detailed vetting of these guys. Once the names come up, I try to make sure I'm really well versed on the top 50 or 60 guys on my list. So when I go to do the draft for NBC, I don't want to be sitting there in the first round. Somebody said, "We proud to select this guy." And you're like, "Oh man, I don't know who that is." So I really trying to hone in on 50 or 60 of them. But So in answer to your question, Kwame, at the time, I don't think they mustn't have felt like they dropped the ball because they were aware of what had happened and they still went ahead and did it. Now, it was a unique time too, though, because they were, you know, Bill Armstrong was the new general manager, but he wasn't presiding over the draft.
Right.
So there technically was no general manager. So somebody else got to make the call. And again, I don't know the ins and outs of what went on at the draft table or what have you, but in answer to your question, once the story became as public as it did and the details emerged and there were a lot of people who weren't satisfied that Mitchell Miller did enough in terms of making amends or that he wasn't sincere enough. And that a lot of people weren't prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt or that second chance, even though he got, then all of a sudden with the backlash coming, then the Coyotes obviously, you know, washed their hands of it.
Yeah. Most of the team you've worked with within the hockey space has been mainly white, as you would know and surely recognize. That's been the case over the years. And I'm curious, was there ever any thoughts to say or conversations to say, like, hey, this is pretty white, this is pretty all male, we need to change something here? Because we see the adjustments in hiring practices now, the free discussions, the conscious efforts to say things like Black Lives Matter, or we need to change hockey culture. And this has only come about because of the pain inflicted upon people of color, mainly Black people. So instead of being proactive, the game of hockey has been reactive.
Yeah, so I think I'm just,
So I just wonder what you thought of that statement. And is the industry of hockey ready to become more proactive and to, you know?
I think more so now. I think there's the, you know, the last, you'd like to think the last year or two in particular has been more of an eye opener for white people and the white establishment in hockey. I'd like to think so, but I guess we'll see is the answer. But yeah, you're probably right, or you are right. I mean, I sit on a panel and it's mostly white people. Now I've worked with Anson Carter at NBC and, I'm trying to think along the way.
Kevin Weeks, did you ever do anything with Kevin?
I've done some stuff with Kevin and, I've known these guys. I knew Anson Carter when he still played for Wexford tier two and Kevin, when he played No One Sound and when I was the editor in chief of the Hockey News, we did a cover story on Kevin and a lot of what was, you know, the discrimination and the racial injustice that he faced in hockey. But I mean, I guess if you're asking me if somewhere along the line I was sitting on the TSN panel and I said, hey, we really need to get people of color in here, I probably didn't. Because I can't remember whether I mentioned it to you or somebody else, but, you know, as I said, there's willfully ignorant people and then there's blissfully ignorant people. And even though, as I said, from the time I was in grade six and I read Black Like Me, I've been aware of racism and discrimination. But in terms of acting on it or what have you, you know, I'm probably stand as guilty as a lot of people for not having done enough.
I just want to point out that you read Black Like Me in grade six. There are some adults right now that haven't even read that book. So I'm truly impressed by your reading vocab. But I mean, as a writer, I'm sure that's just second nature for you and you just enjoy reading.
That was at school. Our teacher, like that.
Oh, really?
That was the Bendale Public School. And I want to say it was grade five or six.
Wow.
That was part of our reading curriculum that year in Bendale.
Interesting. So you announced your semi-retirement this year. What brought you to that decision and what's next for you?
Well, semi-retirement is kind of a funny thing because, you know, it's not full retirement because I didn't want to just shut it down. Mm-hmm. I wanted to stay somewhat busy, but I didn't want to be as busy as I was. Being quote unquote the hockey insider, it's a 24/7 job. So in other words, you got to watch all the games. You got to, you know, I used to, before I, until I semi-retired, I would have 3, 4, 5 radio hits a day across Canada, Monday to Friday. So when you get up on a Monday morning, and you've got you've got Winnipeg radio at 8 o'clock, you got Montreal radio at 8:30, and you've got Edmonton radio at 9 o'clock. You better damn well know what went on in every NHL game last night, and what's going on in Winnipeg, and what's going on in Montreal, and what's going on in Edmonton, and because they could throw anything at you, and you got to be aware of it. So you need to make sure, if you didn't see all the games last night, you better make sure you saw the highlights, that you were reading Twitter and social media. Was there an offside call last night people are going to be talking about? Was there a head hit that somebody's going to be talking about? Is there a trade rumor or a coach on a hot seat? You really need to be on top of absolutely everything, and it kind of dominates your life.
Right.
And so I turned 64 in August, and it was also a natural time. I had a 10-year contract at TSN that expired. It was supposed to expire on July 1st, but with the pandemic, things got pushed back a little bit. Anyways, long story short, I kind of knew I wanted to take a step back. I wanted to get out of the day-to-day grind, and I'm a granddad now. I got a couple of grandchildren that I like to go see, and I got two sons. One's a broadcaster with Rogers and Hockey Night in Canada. My son, Sean, is on TV. My other son, Mike, who's got the two kids. He's the general manager and now head coach of the Kitchener Rangers. And so, you know, I like to go down and spend time watching Kitchener. Well, if the pandemic wasn't on, I'd like to go down and watch those OHL games and tell my son what he should be doing as a general manager or head coach, and telling my other son how he should be broadcasting and all that stuff. So, but I'm still busy. I got World Juniors that I'm still doing for the next 5 years. I got draft rankings I'm still doing for the next 5 years. Free agent frenzy and trade deadline day, those marathon days at TSN, I still get to do that. And there'll be a handful of Toronto Maple Leaf regional games that I'll do on TSN as well. So I'll still be somewhat busy, but now when I go visit my grandkids, I can leave the phone in the car, or if I'm at a family function or a wedding or somewhere, I can just turn the phone off and say, nobody needs to get hold of me and I don't need to get hold of anybody else. It kind of allows you to be a little bit more in the moment.
That's awesome. 2020 has been an eye-opening year. I truly believe the universe, and I say the universe because that's the higher power, and I don't care to say who, you know, whoever you pray to.
Yep.
It's just the universe. I feel like it's sending us a message to change from the start of the year. What message does hockey need to pay attention most of going forward, especially with this pandemic and everything that's been going on?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. And I don't just mean in terms of people of color, but it's diversity, inclusion, call it whatever you want. And that's why these last two books I've done, these Everyday Hockey Heroes books, Volume 1 and Volume 2, they've been a game changer for me, because there's a lot of really inspiring stories there of people who, for one reason or another, were maybe having difficulty with the hockey culture, but found a way around it, found a way through it, broke down some barriers. And I just think we all just need to be, everybody just needs to be a little kinder across the board, and whatever form that comes in. And as I said, for your audience, obviously the emphasis would be more on race. But I mean, it's certainly not exclusive to that. I said, because there's a whole, what I've come to realize, and again, I talk a little bit about white privilege in the chapter I wrote about Terry Mercury and Lindbergh Gonzalez. All white privilege is people think it's a negative connotation. It's more just an observational status, if you want. And that is, you know, somebody could say to you, what's hockey culture like? You say, oh, I think it's fine. Well, yeah, it's fine for me, because I've never been pushed to the margins. Because I'm white and I'm part of the mainstream media and I'm part of the establishment. So I just hope that over time here, and sooner rather than later, more and more people like myself will just simply understand that they are privileged to not have to have had to think about all these things on a consistent basis. And that maybe now is the time where we need to all think about it on a more consistent basis, not just in terms of Black or Indigenous or people of color, but LGBTQ or women or whatever the case may be. There's a whole bunch of people that want to be part of this game, but feel a little bit marginalized. Mm-hmm. And it's our duty as people that have been part of this game for a long time, just try and make it more welcoming and just try to be kinder.
What would you want the hockey world to say about Bob McKenzie's contribution to the game?
Oh, that's a tough one. I don't know. I don't know that I've ever given it too much thought, other than just, you know, probably early on, I was like a lot of people, you want to make your mark, you want to be famous, you want to be successful, you want to do all those things. And listen, I'm not going to be shy that, you know, I worked hard and pushed hard and was aggressive in trying to make all those things happen. But at the end of the day, I think it kind of goes back to, you know, just, and I've probably realized this a lot more over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years than I did when I was your age, Akil. You know, whether you're a player in this game or whether you're in the media or whatever part of it you hold in as part of the hockey culture or hockey establishment or hockey world, you know, you have to have a singular desire to be successful at times. And sometimes that singular desire sometimes creates, you know, a tendency to be a little bit self-centered. Mm-hmm. That everything, you know, you're so focused on getting ahead and being successful and making it that you kind of put blinders up and you kind of forget about everything else that's out there. And so what I've probably come to realize over time is you can still have that quote unquote singular focus, but you can still be a little more aware of what's going on in your surroundings. And so in answer to your question, it would just be nice if people said, hey, you know what? Good guy, worked hard. Yeah. But, you know, and it sounds like a cliche. It's like getting pucks deep for hockey, but you know what? Just, hey, he was a good dude and he worked hard and did a good job. That's his, end of the day, that's pretty good.
Definitely a good dude, definitely works really hard in the game, and you know, we appreciate your work over the years. Brother B, Brian, who you met earlier, is with our social media guy. When I told him that we had you on the show, he said, Uncle Bob's coming on. So
I get even, that a lot.
Even down south, they know Uncle Bob. So we really appreciate you, my friend. And you know, at the top of the show, I called you the Mac, and I called you the Mac for the reason that when I look at you, I say to myself, this is a guy that knows his music. This is a guy that on his way to the studio, he's cranking it. He may have the windows up. People don't know what's going on, but inside that car, there's some music banging. So what we like to do at the end of our show is we like to find out our guests' top five songs that they are jamming to. So give us the Mac Man's top five.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm jamming to some of these, but they're songs that mean a lot to me.
Okay.
for various reasons. And I'll get to my number one in a minute, but I should first off say, like, I'm a big Tragically Hip guy. I absolutely love the Tragically Hip. And I got to know Gord Downie and the guys. And that's my band. Like, that, that's the band that really talks to me. But I like all music, really. Okay. Across the board. So when I was a kid growing up, I really liked Creedence Clearwater Revival. That brings back memories of being a kid. And I love John Fogerty. And so my number five song would be Born on the Bayou. I really like that. When I did my podcast called The Bobcast, that was my extra music, was Born on the Bayou. There's another song, and I bring it up probably a little bit to pander to your audience. But I was listening to Howard Stern a couple of years ago. Okay. And Gary Clark Jr. was on. Yep. Had an interview on Howard Stern. And I really like guitar players, whether Stevie Ray Vaughan or Gary Clark Jr. or whatever. And he told a great story about the album that he was doing and the song in particular, this called This Land. And it's an unbelievable song. And if you go on Spotify and you do it on your cell phone, you'll get the images as well, like the video. And it's really, really graphic. The imagery and the images that Gary Clark Jr. puts up for this song, which of course is about overt racism at his home in Texas. And the story that he told about that on Howard Stern, that song, like the guitar is searing, it's fantastic, but it's also like really dark and edgy and got this really undercurrent of the dark side of the racism that Gary Clark Jr. was experiencing.
Gary Clark Jr., by the way, is good friends of former Maple Leaf Mark Fraser. Just wanted to add that in there.
Oh, that's cool. And I'm somewhat pals with Mark Fraser's brother, who worked in the Prime Minister's office once upon a time in Ottawa.
Nice.
So, and number three, and I don't listen to this very often, but I wanted to include it on my list of meaningful songs. My dad was an Irish tenor. Okay. And he was a great singer. And so there's a guy that used to work at the Toronto Sun. And then he went on and he's had all sorts of albums. His name's John McDermott. And he's a Scotsman, but he sings a great a cappella version of Danny Boy. So that's a really cool song that if I ever want to think about my dad who passed away in 2003, that was pretty cool.
Okay.
Number two, this one's kind of bizarre because it's not many people like classical music or opera, but Andrea Bocelli for me has like the most incredible voice I've ever heard. And I actually saw him in concert with Ray Ferraro at the, when San Jose and Pittsburgh were in the cup final, Bocelli was playing a concert at the Shark Tank and I got tickets to go see that. And there's a song called Sognos, which is S-O-G-N-O-S. And it's the most incredible voice I've ever heard ever. For anything. So that one is there. And then my number one, I could pick any Tragically Hip song, but the one I use to wake up, it's my alarm when I wake up in the morning. It's A Good Life If You Don't Weaken, and by Gord Downie and the Tragically Hip. So,
nice.
But I love all the Hip songs. When I go riding on my bike for an hour or two, I just put on the Tragically Hips on Spotify, every album they've got, and just put it on shuffle and away we go. So,
and let it flow. And speaking of Spotify, you can hear Bob's top five song on our Soul on Ice, the podcast Spotify list. And so there's some stuff there that, you know, I hope our audience is, I'm curious about that. Let me hear what Bob listens to. Listen, Bob, thank you so much for joining. Quick question for you. I read this on Wikipedia. Did you actually almost get into it with, was it Tony Esposito or Phil Esposito?
Phil Esposito. Mm. I didn't get into it. I actually charged him with assault.
Wow.
That's a long story for another day.
That's for another day.
That's going to get me back on Soul on Ice. I think.
There you go. We're going to have you back in to tell us that story. And lastly,
Phil and I are pals now. But yeah, I charged him with assault because he whacked me in the. Now some people would say I deserved it, but that's another story for another day too.
don't put your hands on me. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but I made a film called Soul on Ice: Past, Present, and Future, which is about the history and contribution of Black athletes in hockey. I want the next time you see Darren Dutition, you give him hell because I wanted you in the film. I wanted to have you as one of my talking heads because I always respected your work and I thought you would have great insight in this. And I can't remember, how did I get there? For some reason, I was in the TSM building. I met Dutchie and he was wearing his tight suits. And I asked him, I was like, I really like to get Bob McKenzie on this and I want your voice on it too. And Darren was like, yeah, of course. He just ghosted me on emails. So I want two things. I want you to know that you should have been in my film. And the reason why you're not in the film is because of Dutchie.
Wow. Dutchie ghosting you. That's not very good, but I gotta be careful. I say anything. Cause as you know, like Dutchie looks like he could bench press Texas Stadium, as they say. And I don't know. I want to mess. And he's from Saskatchewan too, from Saskatchewan. You don't mess with those guys. Yeah. Kelly Chase and all those guys. You don't mess with those guys.
There you go. Akil, got any last words for Bob before we let him go?
No, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it. And, you know, it was awesome. And definitely got to get you back on to tell us about those stories there.
Oh, yeah, there's quite a few there. Well, guys, thanks for having me on, Kwame. Really appreciate it, Akil. Thanks. Good luck the rest of the way this season. Hopefully see you in the NHL sooner rather than later. And number 11, proud Scarberian, going to make it. And the number 11 black player from Scarborough. Well done.
Thank you.
Hey, so you said it. First black player from Scarborough was Mike Marzen. Did you know that the Marzen family is the first black family in Scarborough?
I did not know that. But I will tell you this. When my son Mike was 4 years old, 5 years old, mm-hmm. he learned to skate at the Larry Marzen Power Skating School at Art Thompson Arena in Pickering.
Look at that.
And when my son Mike was... He was struggling with confidence and physical play in minor peewee. He hadn't gone through puberty and a lot of other guys had. And I got hold of Mike Marzen and Mike did some training with my son, Mike.
You sent him, him into the dojo.
We actually put, We put, and when we were doing the NHL on TSN, we actually had Mike Marzen come on with the full judo outfit on, and we on the NHL on TSN, a nationally broadcast game, and he was fantastic. I love the Marzens; they're awesome.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bob McKenzie, thank you, Bob.
Awesome guys, have a good one. Thanks very much for having me.
There you have it, folks. Uncle Bob, the Mac, Bob McKenzie, right here on Soul on Ice, the podcast. Keel Thomas. He is the guy you think about when it comes to draft rankings and World Juniors. So it's really cool to have him on. What are your thoughts?
A lot of thoughts. I remember just being a little kid, like watching TV and him talking all the time. So kind of funny how you know, he's on our podcast. So I thought that was pretty cool. Some questions that I've wanted to ask him since I was like 10. So yeah, it was awesome for me. He's a, you know, I'm looking forward to getting a hold of his book because I'm sure there's some cool insights, some cool stories and a different perspective. So, really interesting guy. And, you know, he's gonna, you know, go down as, you know, one of the most, you know, influential hockey minds out there. And, it was awesome talking to him.
His book is called Everyday Hockey Heroes Volume 2. Make sure you pick it up in stores. And speaking of picking things up, get 20% off and free shipping with the promo code SOUL, S-O-U-L, at manscaped.com. It's all about male hygiene, my friends. Make sure you get yours while this promotion is lasting. Manscaped.com. Promo code SOUL, free shipping, 20% off. And, you know, we missed Elijah, who I know would have loved to have been on this one. But for Elijah Roberts, Akil Thomas, my name is Kwame. Thank you for joining us. Make sure you check us out on all social media platforms, Soul on Ice, the podcast, as well as our Spotify list. And also, we have a Reddit community, so make sure you check that out. We'll see you here next week. Thank you for joining us. Peace out. We Audi 5000.
And when we make it, we gon' put our soul on ice. Cause when they doubted us, we did it twice. I guess the poop is in the freezer. They tried to get rid of us, but they need us. So I need you like you need me. I need you like you need me. We double up when our numbers come through. Soul on ice, I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice. You goddamn right, I'm screaming on that beat. I got a match screaming on the streets. We in the club, stadium, and the arena, cousin. Put me on ice and I'm hitting that top. Trees are dusting, fussing, fighting with myself is enticing. My enemies in the mirror, and he's always reciting the poetry of my power. Statistic of my weakness, shadow boxing with Tyson. I'm trying to show y'all I'm beating them to the...
crunch. Competition on the table. Which type of lunch? Though my mission is unstable, I'm scoring once, twice, three times, and I'm taking hats. Men lie, women lie. Progress is based upon the facts. So let that baby shine. They sold a show and know the. They live within the grind. Now take them out that stroller, cause coming up is a champ. Prediction of Ali. He changed his name to Muhammad. We changing free to a fee. It's up to me. And when we make it, we gon' put our soul on ice. Cause when they doubted us, we did it twice. I guess the proof is in the freezer. They tried to get rid of us, but they need us. So I need you, like you need me. I need you, like you need me. We double up when our numbers come through the TV. Soul on ice, I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice. Let's dedicate this one to Jade and Linda. Let's escalate to Caddy, crush the Pinta. Or maybe you prefer that Benz, why? That big truck, I don't give a f***. Only really want a house for the gift. Let's take it far down on the competition. Competition is nonsense, it's me and my soul's decision. Yeah, I only work against myself. I play against you to bench you. I'm throwing all shots to the shelf. Yeah, the top is the topic. You checking your armor. My wheel telescopic, so I'm steering my karma. The future is mine, like receiving the pass from Jesus or Jordan or Crosby, Stills and Nash. We young, and when we make it, we gon' put our soul on ice. Cause when they doubted us, we did it twice. I guess the proof is in the freezer. They tried to get rid of us, but they need us. So I need you, like you need me. I need you, like you need me. When our numbers come through the TV, soul on ice, I'ma put my soul on ice. Nice.